Welcome back to KSCJ Radio, 1360 AM, 94.9 FM in Sioux City, Iowa. I'm Brian Vikalskis, and this is Having Read That, conversations with authors about their books.
My guest is Julie Clark. Her latest novel is The Last Flight. The book is available now wherever your fine books are sold. This takes us through one of those questions that I'm sure all of us have had at one time or another. What would happen if I could just disappear and start over again? Julie, set this up for us. People disappear every day, as it says, as you wrote in the novel. But what is so special about this one? Because Claire is a woman who would like to disappear, start a new life, but it's just not that easy to walk away, is it?
No, it's not. And it's especially not easy for Claire because she's married to a very powerful man. Her husband, Rory, is the beloved son of a former senator, and this family is very powerful politically, like really second only to the Kennedys. And so everybody loves Rory. Everybody adores him. He's sort of like our national child that everybody watched growing up on the pages of People. And so for Claire to come forward and accuse her husband of the abuse that he's been putting her through for the last decade, she knows that people wouldn't necessarily want to hear that or believe it. And so she's not really interested in having that play out in the media. She's not really interested in having her background picked apart and her character kind of assassinated in a way that we've seen play out in our own news. And so she decides to use Rory's money and access to buy herself a new life. She gets a fake ID, she gets a new passport, she gets a new driver's license, she buys a new name, a new social security number. She does all of this work to prepare to disappear because that's really all she wants, is to get her life back. She's not interested in making a statement. She's not interested in holding him accountable because she doesn't believe that she ever could.
What kind of practical things does someone have to go through in their own mind in order to make this work? Because there's certain family things at play with the people that Claire grew up with that don't affect the fact that she's going to be gone and walking away from her current life.
I think in order for something like this to happen, I mean, Claire is sort of alone in the world. Her only family, her mother and her younger sister, passed away many years ago, and I think that is sort of what Rory looks for in a partner, is somebody who's sort of unattached and can be easily isolated, as many abusers do. And so Claire really didn't have a lot of attachments. She has one very close friend in New York that helps her, and it really is a severing of their friendship when Claire leaves, because there's no way that you can keep in touch with anybody in your former life once you disappear. You know, we read about it all the time in, like, witness protection books about people who have to be relocated by the FBI, and there's just no connecting with your old life because it's simply not safe to do so. So I needed to set it up so that, first of all, Claire would be able to do something like that, and that there wouldn't be a lot of ties for her to feel compelled to return.
This book is set up as such that Claire is going to originally start a new life for herself as somebody who doesn't exist, and then things happen where it's possible that she's going to assume the life of someone who did exist. What types of things go through into planning if you're going to take over an actual live person's life versus just starting a new one on your own?
Well, I think as soon as you pick up somebody else's name and their social security number, you pick up their debt, you pick up their credit card bill, you pick up all of the things that we sort of accumulate as citizens in the world, and Eva, who is a woman who's also on the run and also in great danger, has a life that she desperately also needs to step out of. And the women, when they meet at the airport, don't have any intention of trading identities other than using the plane tickets as a way to get somewhere untraceable. So when Claire plans to fly to Oakland on Eva's ticket, she is only doing so as a way to get herself to California, where her husband Rory would never, ever think to look for her. And there's no trail, no digital footprint leading him to her there. But obviously when she lands and realizes that the plane carrying Eva crashed, she has a bigger problem because now media reports are reporting Claire as perishing in the plane crash, beloved wife of Rory Cook has died, and, you know, she's all over the national news. And so she needs a place to hide, and she decides to hide out at Eva's house. She knows that Eva's not coming back to it because Eva was on the plane.
Oakland plays a major role here, and a college town is such a great place to disappear into. Why is that?
I think because there's so much transient in and out, you know, we have students. I worked for a number of years at Berkeley, and so I really wanted to set a book there. I worked in the athletic department for a number of years and loved the town, loved my life there, loved the people that I worked with and the people that I met. And it was really fun to go back in my mind and to actually physically go back to Berkeley and walk those streets again, walk those paths, walk through campus, listen to the Campanile ring and the library and all of those places that I loved so much. And a college town pretty much renews itself every 4 years with all new people. So it's a prime opportunity for somebody to be anonymous in a way that maybe you wouldn't be able to be in a smaller town or in a town that doesn't have a university with a continuously circulating population of people.
You're a California native, grew up there. What's the cultural difference between Southern California, where you grew up, and Northern California, where a lot of this book is set?
You know, there's a big, you know, there's always been, you know, NorCal versus SoCal. I think they're different in the sense that Southern California growing up for me in the 70s and 80s was very laid back and sleepy. Northern California is, the climate's different. The people are different. You know, in Southern California, there weren't a lot of like political activists. In Santa Monica, especially, it was not sort of a hotbed of political discourse in the same way that Berkeley is, obviously. Historically, Berkeley has been, you know, a center of political discourse and protests and issues that are relevant to our world. And so working at Berkeley and living there for a number of years opened my eyes to a lot of things that, you know, as a white woman growing up in Southern California and Santa Monica, like, just weren't on my radar in a way. It was a huge gift to me to be more aware, and Berkeley's just an amazing place like that. It's a place that challenges your thinking. It's a place that makes you just take a step back and look at the world in a completely different way, I think simply because it's so diverse.
I'm chatting with Julie Clark about her latest novel, The Last Flight. The book is available now wherever your fine books are sold, and it truly is a thriller. Julie, when you write a thriller like this, this was an edge of your seat or edge of the bed, depending on where you read, type of a book. And the writing is very tight, and that's just the nature of the beast when you're writing a thriller. You can't waste words. So how much did you have to tighten up the story in order to make the thriller part work?
A lot. I mean, you know, whenever you write a book, you're getting to know your characters in the same way that you would get to know anybody that you meet for the first time. And so, you know, first you need to go through sort of the pleasantries and, you know, who are you and where are you from and what do? And what do you care about? And as an author, you have to do that with your characters as well, because even though you're inventing them, you still have to create kind of a backstory and a history for each of your characters that rings true for your readers. And so there's a lot of exploration and a lot of reflection and imagining and writing that never ends up making it in the book, simply because that's how you get to know your characters and that's how you get to understand who they are and what their passions are and what they care about and what they struggle with. So that's a really fun part of writing, in my opinion. I enjoy experiencing that, but it does mean that when you hit your target 80,000 words for a first draft of a novel, you know that probably 30% of that's going to get cut because it's just rambling and telling yourself the story and telling yourself about who these people are that aren't really, that it isn't really necessary for the book in its final form. You know, a lot of the information, a lot of the backstory can be told through dialogue, through through decisions that characters make or things that they don't make. There's a lot of ways to reveal who a person is without them having to tell you explicitly anything about themselves.
Do you struggle sometimes as a writer trying to figure out a way to throw a part of a backstory that's relevant and that you need to get out, but you need to get it out in few words into dialogue with a character? And I'm going to make this part up, but you do it in a cheap way, like, hey, remember when we stole that thing from a candy store when we were kids? I mean, it sounds almost fake, so how much struggle is it to make that sound like real dialogue, but nonetheless you're trying to get out a backstory?
Oh, it's always a struggle. I mean, like, it's an incredible struggle. And it's always, as an author, you just do those things. You write it that way for the first draft. And you know that when you go back to rewrite and revise, you're going to have to change it. But at least it's, for me at least, it's words on the page. And then you can back it up. And, a good trick is to take that, hey, remember when, and make it internal and make it based on a decision that your character is going to have to make or a feeling that your character is having, so that there's a reason why they do or they don't do something. So it's not just, hey, remember when I did that, but I can't make this decision now because the last time I made a decision like that, this is what happened. So if you contextualize it, then it's not your character retelling something. It's your character using that experience to inform a decision that they make moving forward, which is a lot more authentic, because we don't sit here and tell ourselves stories about ourselves in our head. We don't say, oh gosh, remember that time when I did this? It always informs our actions moving forward.
You mentioned Berkeley. You spent time there, obviously, and loved it. A friend of mine was there the night that Saigon fell and told me the story about how there was just this impromptu march around the area, around the town, around the campus. Do you think that Berkeley is its own little personality and it just attracts a certain type of person that wants to be involved in that? I mean, it seems like the town reinvents itself every 4 years, but it's the same type of activism, or has the activism slowed over the years?
I don't think it's slowed over the years, although I don't live there anymore and haven't lived there for probably 20, 25 years, so I couldn't really speak to how it is today. But I do have friends that still live there, and Berkeley is always going to be Berkeley. And I think that one of the reasons why is that the university is such an anchor for the town, and it has to do with the faculty that work there and the professors and the research. And, so those people who are think tanks and those people that are on the cutting edge of, activism draw and attract the students who are also equally interested in that.
When you go back after 20, 25 years, and if you were to just bop in, does the place ever lose anything? I mean, is there things you don't recognize if you've been back?
Yeah, sure. I mean, the campus is relatively unchanged. There's new buildings here and there. There's, the stadium is upgraded. There's all new, club levels. And, in the athletic department especially, they're constantly remodeling and reworking and making it better. One of the disappointments when I went back, Memorial Stadium is a very old stadium, and it's historic in just its structure. And it's been upgraded and renovated, but the integrity of the stadium has remained the same. But what has changed since I worked there was that it used to be that you could just walk up the hill and walk through the tunnel and be on the field, and now everything is closed off. You need an ID to get in. You need a key. You need access. You need somebody to let you in. It's just not as open as it used to be. And so that was a little bit of a disappointment when I went back, was that I couldn't just take my kids into the stadium and walk up to the top and look out down across over the entirety of Berkeley toward the bay and the Golden Gate Bridge in the distance in the way that anybody could 25 years ago. And that's just sort of the nature of our changing times, I think.
It's like a travel brochure. It makes me want to go back and visit now. The book is The Last Flight by Julie Clark. The book's available now wherever you find books are sold. Absolute thriller. You need one night to read it, and it will keep you up literally at night because it is such an exciting book. Julie, just a fantastic offering, and thanks for joining us to talk about it.
Thanks so much for having me. I appreciate it.
This has been Having Read That on KSCJ Radio in Sioux City, Iowa. I'm Brian Vakalskas. Check out all of our episodes on our website, kscj.com. Also, be sure to like Having Read That on Facebook and subscribe to our iTunes podcast. Thanks to segment producer John Weisler. We will be back next time.